And at least in part, it's about the women who could be the scariest of all. And that is definitely part of the story of Monsters and Monarchs, Serial Killers in Classical Myth and History. Debbie Felton will talk about the women who ordinarily don't get the same attention as the ancient men next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. You mentioned Anne Rule earlier, Debbie Felton, and she was a big believer in equality when it comes to coverage of perpetrators, female perpetrators. And so many of her books were focused on women who had committed horrible crimes. And this is part of what in the tradition of true crime magazines, that was kind of the groundbreaking work that a lot of those magazines did in the 1930s. They covered women in crime. In fact, there was a whole popular true crime magazine called Women in Crime and Women Who Kill. And this is a time when everybody thought, well, you know, women are they're naturally kind and gentle, and they don't have these thoughts, and they must be possessed by the devil for them to do something like that. But somehow it factored that, oh yeah, well, guys do that kind of stuff all the time, but not women. And it wasn't until the 1960s when criminology kind of reconsidered female perpetration, especially as it pertain to our justice system, and you know, expanding the female penitentiaries, and the more liberated women in that societal sense were, the higher the murder rate went up. Women are feeling the same pressures that guys did, perhaps, and acted out in just the same inappropriate ways. But history tells a different story. And in fact, if the historical record is to be believed based on your book, you know, this is part of a much longer pattern of women as killers.
Well, sure. I mean, I think the approximation is that maybe one out of every six serial killers is a woman, and that's not necessarily counting women who work as a partner with a man, because I mean there are certainly these pairs of serial killers as well. But so yeah, historically women have always played a larger role in these sorts of crimes than people generally might think, women's preferred manner of killing has also historically tended more towards poison,
right,
than towards, you know, something more gory and hands on, and there are a lot of reasons for that. I mean, for one thing, women had access to the food because they were the ones who were preparing it.
That's true.
But you know, in terms of serial killing in the ancient world and women, there are some sort of, you know, borderline cases in terms of, well, there's a group of women here and there that seem to have worked together to poison a bunch of men. And if it was women working together and they just killed a bunch of men in a short time, is it more of a spree killing? Is it really serial murder? But the point there, though, is, as you're saying, that women are killers. And so to have these cases, you know, sort of highlighted even in antiquity says, yeah, let's not assume that it's just men who are killers, but that women do it in more devious ways, perhaps, and it's harder to stop them in some ways. So there have been a number of cases of poisoning, especially in antiquity, where large numbers of people, usually men, are killed by women who have poisoned them.
You know, there's a line in a Sherlock Holmes movie, maybe many of them, I don't know, but that poison is a woman's weapon.
Yeah.
And I think, but I hadn't realized the food connection until you mentioned it, because that would certainly, and not just the blood and, you know, the mess to clean up afterward. Right, you had to clean it up, so might as well make that as tidy an operation as possible.
Yeah. Until the 19th century, I'm trying to remember the sort of exact, pin it down a little more, But until it became possible to trace poisons in the body,
right.
I mean, for the longest time, that just couldn't be done with any accuracy, and so it would be so hard to figure out what kind of poison. Was it poison? Was it a heart attack? Was it poison? Was it a stroke? And, you know, what kind of poison, and when did it get in the body, and how long did it take to work? So until forensics of poison, you know, about poisons kind of caught up, poison was used for a particularly long time very effectively until it became less popular because it was more traceable.
Maybe right up until Christian Dior came out with Poison, a perfume line named Poison, which
yeah.
I thought, okay. So give us some examples then of some of the more notorious women in classic Greek and Roman stories who were alleged to be serial killers.
Well, again, keeping in mind that alleging them as serial killers is more from a modern point of view.
Yeah, but that doesn't bother me. I don't care. Let's even get rid of the word alleged, because that's just that's a legal concept anyway.
Yeah,
so let's just say they are.
I just don't want to mislead people into thinking that, you know, the Greeks and Romans used the terminology serial killer to identify
right.
people. It's just like, oh, she's a poisoner and she poisons a lot of people is
right.
how they would describe her. So, yeah, one of the most notorious was Locusta of Gaul, she was probably the single most famous poisoner from ancient Rome. And I suppose one thing I haven't mentioned yet that hasn't come up in our conversation is, in terms of these people being so famous, like Nero, for example, and now I'm seeing Locusta of Gaul, these are well-known people. And these days, when you think of serial killers, at least before they're, you know, before you discover who they are, like Ted Bundy or Dennis Rader, the idea is that they're successful serial killers because they're doing this in private for a long time before anybody finally catches them. So when you've got these people who are just like famous, like, oh, everybody knows Locusta is the poisoner, but you don't catch her actually doing it, so where's the evidence? But anyway, so Locusta lived in the first century CE, and she came from Gaul, which is now modern France, so she's just referred to as Locusta of Gaul. And she made her living as a poisoner for hire. And, she, you know, even though she's basically an assassin, she's still included as a serial killer in a lot of modern compilations of serial killers. You know, just encyclopedias of serial killers will point out, oh, well, there was Locusta of Gaul, and she's one of the closest things we can find to a serial killer in antiquity. So she frequently supplied poisons to other people, but we don't know the extent to which she may have poisoned people herself personally. And this is another one of these nuances of definition that, you know, we sort of have to ignore for, you know, the purposes of examples from antiquity. She became really infamous as a poisoner even in her own time. And she worked for some of the emperors, and she's contemporary with Agrippina and Nero, actually. And Agrippina, Nero's mother, had hired Locusta to poison Claudius, at least in some accounts. In others, it was like, oh, Nero's the one who poisoned the mushrooms. So between the two of them, Agrippina and Nero, working together with Locusta, they managed to knock off quite a few people.
It wasn't exactly arsenic and old lace, though. It wasn't like...
Right.
It wasn't sweet. It wasn't misguided. It was really focused on power and control.
Yeah, I mean, unlike those Brewster sisters who were like,
right.
Let's just put these poor men out of their misery with elderberry wine or whatever.
Right.
This was brutal. I mean, because among other things, Locusta and other poisoners would have to experiment with types of poison and amounts of poison, and sometimes it wouldn't work, and they would just make people really sick initially. That apparently happened with their first attempt on Claudius, that they didn't give him the right amount, or Locusta didn't get the dosage right, et cetera. So the first time Claudius was poisoned, it didn't really have any effect on him. Then Locusta and Agrippina had to conspire with Claudius's doctor to make sure he got enough of a dosage, and it was just a mess. I mean, a lot of these, you know, attempted murders. They the first time they were tempted, they didn't work necessarily, whether it was poison or something else. And Nero wanted Locusta to poison his stepbrother, Britannicus, because Britannicus was actually the heir to being emperor. He was the one like in Nero's way, basically. So he hired Locusta to poison Britannicus. And, again, initially it didn't work. It was the wrong dosage or the wrong type. And Nero was furious, and he had Locusta tortured. Eventually they got to the right amount, and Locusta got it right, and then Britannicus dropped dead at the dinner table, and everybody else at dinner was terrified, and Nero's just sitting there very calmly eating and going, oh, yeah, he hasn't been feeling well.
Hasn't been feeling well lately.
Yeah, and Nero was so pleased with the way Locusta had finally gotten everything right that he rewarded her, gave her some property. He give her immunity or pardons for past crimes. Locusta was a particularly interesting figure because she survived for such a long time. And, again, I don't know if we should consider her a serial killer in the stricter sense of the term, but she's definitely, an infamous poisoner from antiquity who may have poisoned people herself in addition to working for various people in the various members of the imperial family.
But I'm not sure if she's not. I mean, I realize we can parse definitions and stuff, but I think that's, she's certainly a serial assassin, which would make her a serial killer in anybody's book, right?
Difficulties with this whole sort of study is that, does the FBI, for example, count assassins for hire as serial killers? They're doing it professionally. They're being paid for it. They're not doing it in secret. And a lot of the times it'll be a quick hit, instead of having some ritualistic aspect, which is or a signature, for example, or a specific modus operandi that are a little more common maybe for serial killers. But if they're doing it for hire, are they just channeling their tendencies? Would they be more
yes.
what we would think of as a typical serial killer if
yes.
they didn't have this outlet? It's a little hard to know. Technically, these assassins for hire are usually classified differently by law enforcement agencies. But I think you're right. They're still facilitating serial murder.
Yeah, but you look at Richard Kuklinski, right, who was, at least according to his own confession, the Iceman, who was both a serial killer for his own pleasure and somebody who also was a hitman mm-hmm. for the mob, for the Jersey mob and New York crime families. So you look at that and you go, okay, exactly to your point, aren't we creating an artificial definition if we say, assassin isn't a job that just like anybody could do. So, right. You have to kind of be that depraved to think, how much do you want me to do to kill that person? Sure. I'll do that. And then go home and pet your dog.
Yeah. Right? There's this sort of fine line between, you're doing your serial killing for hire to make money versus the serial killers who aren't, who are doing it for themselves, but still for money. They're killing people for the family money, the inheritance, or their Social Security checks or whatever it is. So just because someone's, you're not being hired by someone else, you're just going ahead and doing it for yourself for the money. So, yeah, again, it's sort of...
But the argument would be made that Kuklinski would still be killing people if he hadn't also found a way to make it a lucrative career, that he had to kill. It was just a good way to, pick up some money and to sort of monetize his hobby, right?
Exactly. That is exactly one of the arguments they make about, assassins actually being.
Yeah, totally. The whole Sicario thing that you talk about in the book, which I'm sure you know this, but that Gaul, what we use for modern day France, the same pronunciation, different word, it also means poison.
I thought that was spelled a little differently, like G-A-L-L?
It is. Well, we transliterate it differently
from
from the Hebrew. And so from the Hebrew, we spell it G-A-L-L. But that's interesting that it was associated with poison from both the Hebrew Bible and the Christian New Testament. That same word is used to describe giving a poison to somebody. And here was locusta.
Yeah.
Doing the exact same thing under the same banner. But she's not the only one. And I think this is where, again, we think of, like, if we were to look at the work of, you know, Michel Foucault or something like that, he would say, well, all of this killing and all of these horrible things, they all come as a result of the industrial age and dislocation and people forced to leave the farm and to go to the cities and do whatever. And they become unmoored. And you know, look at what happens to the suicide rate. Look what happens to the murder rate. And maybe really what it comes down to is we just don't have accurate stats on ancient Greece or Rome. We don't have any idea how much murder was going on for fun or profit, you know, millennia ago.
Well, sure. And the other thing, too, is that these accounts all come from the upper classes, about the upper classes normally.
Right.
So if there was an equivalent of Jack the Ripper, you know, in ancient Rome, going in the slums and killing prostitutes, it wouldn't have made the record books. I mean, the historians wouldn't have remarked on it because who cares what happens in the slums of
right.
Rome?
It may not actually even have been illegal.
circles. That's an interesting question because, killing a citizen, even if it was a lower class citizen, that was still a crime. But the Romans didn't necessarily bother themselves about it in the same way that the Greeks did. With these law codes in Greece, like in Athens, they probably would have taken those sorts of cases more seriously if they had even come up. But aside from prostitutes, what little we know about the murder rate of them was that women tended not to be victims as much in antiquity because they really were not allowed to go out in public on their own much at all without male family members with them.
That's very interesting. And so in a way that protected them from the big bad wolves that were out there. And if they did go out there, this is what they had to fear. Which is, again, goes back to an argument I make all the time that I think the true crime is really just there are modern folk tales. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the reasons why we don't have new folk tales. We have true crime because that is what we use to reinforce normative behavior all the time. Don't do this. Don't do that. And here's why. And this is here are the aberrant people. And here's how the rich people try to get away with it. And here's how other people, you know what I mean? I just think that those are abundant and we learn from them. And that's why they're so enormously popular and so enormously popular with women that 70% of all true crime consumers are women.
I didn't know that. That's actually pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And a little disturbing.
but why? If in some cases, I mean, some of the true crime books are passed down as almost sort of a rite of passage from mother to daughter, you know, when women are going out for the first time and they're going on dates or when they're, you know, they're going to a club. It's important if you don't know who are the people out there, who are the big bad wolves? Who do we need to be afraid of? And I think that's where so many of these stories, as much as they are also, we also have this thing, right, where it's, and they're also in the Bible, we have these things about wanting scary stories. We like scary stories. And somehow scary stories may be better if they're by the rich and famous who we're very likely to never actually interact with.
Yeah. And I think the reason, it's so disturbing is the fact that women have to be careful about these things, you know, constantly over the centuries and millennia.
Right.
So it's not that women are so interested in the true crime. It's that they need to be aware of what's going on around them so they don't become victims. That's the disturbing part. And, to what you're saying about the folktale aspect of all this, that, you know, there are some...
You got to hold that thought. We're coming up on a break. Hold that thought. We'll come right back to it. Debbie Felton, Monsters and Monarchs, and we'll get to your calls, too, next hour on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. You know, it's interesting how when we look at these stories that we think otherwise, you know, are somewhat recent. We think serial killers are a something that we've monopolized into a kind of into a media that's on every platform. Right. I mean, serial killer stories are everywhere. And some people look forward to every month becoming a new, you know, installment in this giant corpus on doesn't matter what digital platform or regular broadcast television or in a podcast or whatever. And think of all the serial killer podcasts that are out there. My favorite murder is just one of them. And yet in this one big giant sort of vein of history has gone relatively unexplored until Monsters and Monarchs, Debbie Felton's Serial Killers in Classical Myth and History. And by the way, too, she references Mindhunter in the book. We had on John Douglas, remember, on Coast to Coast when that book came out. And we talked to him. I very much enjoyed that conversation with John Douglas. And then that series that came out from David Fincher, which had two seasons and everybody was waiting for the third. Maybe you heard that the announcement has been made that perhaps a third season is underway. And it is a fictionalized version of part of that story in Mindhunter. It's just... I was so addicted to that because of how we also began to understand the psychology of serial killers while watching this fictionalized version of how the FBI came to terms with the psychology of serial killers. And we'll get back to all that coming up in just a minute. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Debbie Felton, Monsters and Monarchs. We were heading into the break at the bottom of the hour, and I kind of had to... stop her there just because and by the way too, I'm not doing justice to this book. I'm trying to, but there's just so much material, and you did such a nice job focusing on this period, which, and you know, kind of shifting our filters a little bit so that we see and hear these stories differently, and especially with regard to women and how many of them had committed crimes. What would you say is the motive for women to be serial killers? And just go with me on that definition. For women to be serial killers in the ancient world versus men?
Let's see, the motive. I mean, the motives seem to be a little similar, again, because we're dealing with the aristocracy. So power seems to be one of the main motives. Power and money are the two motives. Excuse me. So what you don't see that you might expect are stories about, say, jealousy and killing other women because your husband is being unfaithful with them or something along those lines.
Right, right.
So it's jostling for power, and if it's not power for yourself, as was often the case, it's power for your son, you know, or someone, you know, like usually a son, very closely related, to make sure that the position or the money doesn't go to some other relative that is not your first choice, for example. Sometimes you're sick of a husband or two, and you want to get rid of them and have a third option that'll get you a higher position of power or more in, you know, a bigger estate, something along those lines.
Right.
So I'm not sure that the motives are all that different. One thing is that we just don't have a lot of information about the motives necessarily, so we're inferring quite a bit.
You know, let's go with that for a second, because there is this, as I think you're alluding to, this kind of trope that says, you know, women kill men out, you know, for revenge of having been, you know, done wrong, so that women kill out of love, men kill out of sex, that in just these, fair or not fair, it's been said many times. And this was at least a prejudice that went into how people viewed women as revenge killers, ergo the poisons and things that were just sort of subtle reclamation of one's power. But you hit on something which is underscored, which is that in the ancient world, just like it is today, just like a woman that might be killing for the insurance money, is that the margins of having enough money to be able to get by into some sort of retirement where you didn't end up spending the rest of your life on the streets were pretty narrow in the ancient world. And so if it meant knocking off a few people so that you lived in comfort for the rest of your days, that might seem like a gamble worth taking for certain women.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly seems to be the case. I mean, which isn't to say that there weren't also, like, serial killings for passion or revenge. Those tend to occur more in the mythology than in the historical accounts. Like Medea, for example, is someone I think we could call a serial killer. She kills her brother, and then she kills her rival for Jason's affections, and then she kills her own children to spite Jason, and she continues to go. You know, she kills Jason's rival for power. So Medea actually kills quite a lot of people in Greek myth.
I miss that Tyler Perry movie. I thought they were comedies. I never realized.
Yeah, this is like the ongoing thing is I sometimes literally give spelling quizzes in my classes because the number of times I get Medea instead of Medea is pretty funny.
Yeah. So, but I think this is a good point. So, and I wonder whether to what degree then if we again go down into the lower classes, if that's the upper class thing, then lower classes, what were they killing each other over if they had so little? And then I think, well, they were killing each other over so little. The difference was people killing each other over more or less, but they're still killing each other.
Yeah, and I mean, we just don't have any, we just don't have those accounts. I mean, it's not like I necessarily found every single story that might qualify as serial killing, so I'm sure there's still some stories out there to find, and maybe there are some stories about the lower classes, I personally haven't uncovered yet, and somebody else will. But for right now, we just don't know. We've got all these stories of women killing unwanted suitors, sometimes with the help of their family members. And I'm not talking about Odysseus necessarily this time, but there are other stories from myth where these princesses, have suitors one at a time rather than en masse, like in the case of Penelope. And, either their father, the king, doesn't want them to marry, or they themselves don't want to marry. So they put all these obstacles in the suitors' ways, and then it's like either you solve this riddle or you get killed, or you win this foot race or you get killed. So there's a weird sort of serial killer dynamic going on there in terms of winning the hand of the princess. Some very harsh penalties if you don't win. Yeah.
Right. But, that reminds me then, too, of, and I know this is a little bit outside of the scope of the book, but we never really talk about Henry the Eighth as a serial killer, right?
Well, and how many of his wives did he actually kill or have executed? Wasn't it just like one or two?
Well, but we never talk about it that way. We never say whether he didn't necessarily kill them, but he had them killed.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, if you're going to, I remember once I was at a Renaissance fair somewhere, and somebody's walking around being Henry VIII with some big turkey leg. And I said, serial killer. And they're looking at me like, you're ruining it. Like, this is what are you saying that? But he was, I mean, why wouldn't we say he would be today? If we thought of it, that he hired people to do his bidding to kill his wives, just like in the story, how many in your book, I say story in the book, how many times do prolific killers kill a series of wives?
Yeah. Yeah, there are, I would say yes with the Henry VIII, and that yes, there are a number of men who kill a series of wives, and it's the same idea as far as say Henry VIII goes. Sort of like some of the emperors, these are the monarchs that abuse their power. I mean, because with Henry VIII, that was what trumped up charges for Anne Boleyn. I mean, she didn't produce a male heir. She was accused of being a witch. Various things. And then in antiquity, I'm not sure we see quite as many of those, but there are attempts to find these sort of Bluebeard figures in antiquity, or at least to speculate about them. But one of the examples that I like, which is a little later and isn't from classical antiquity per se, But the story of the Thousand Nights and a Night, the what we sometimes call by shorthand the Arabian Nights, where the king, because his first wife was unfaithful to him, he decides that he's going to get revenge for the embarrassment by marrying, you know, a new maiden every day and then executing her until Shahrazad comes along and tells him a story that distracts him, and he wants to hear the rest of it, so he doesn't kill her yet. And this just goes on until she has borne him children. And he decides that he's just going to go ahead and keep her after all. But yeah, the killing of a series of wives for various reasons does show up.
You know, and the same stories in some respects appear in the Bible. There's a lot. I got a tweet at Deacon Punnett, my Twitter handle, from somebody who says, "What about Samson? What about people who?" Although they may not have been a serial killer, certainly were mass killers.
Mass killers, yeah. Samson, like, just brought down the structure, right, because he was being tortured and about to be killed himself. So is that the particular episode you're referring to? Where
no. No, because he killed people before that. I mean, and there's lots of stories of going on a rampage and killing innocent people. It's part of what built his reputation. It's part of what got him to where he was in the end. And I think this is where there's this sort of flex that we, if we're going to use the way the kids talk about it today. And so there was sort of this flex of power, and we see that kind of thing a lot. But it's almost as though, again, because somebody's a monarch or somebody was a judge, which had a different connotation in the original Hebrew, that somebody was a judge, that they were given this latitude to kill, just kind of kill people because they felt like it.
Yeah,
it really comes right down to it.
Definitely abuse of power. I mean, yeah. It's no question. And yeah, I'm sorry, I haven't read the story of Samson since I was little, so
right.
I forgot all the details. But he's sort of he's a sort of a parallel to Heracles in,
right.
in a lot of ways in terms of being the strong man and having the problems with women.
Right. Yeah. How much of that, by the way, do we see a kind of psychosexual component to this exertion of power with regard to an inability to have a decent relationship with a woman, or it, maybe in the twofer, they've got a really kind of twisted relationship with mom, and therefore they have a very difficult relationship with women in their peer group?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Those are definitely all interconnected. But it sort of depends if you're talking about the historical figures or the mythological heroes or both, because with the mythological heroes, part of the pattern for most of them is their inability to have a stable relationship, and it's not necessarily connected to mother issues. It's because of the nature of the hero. It's like pretty much the only ancient hero who had positive relationships with the women in his life was Perseus. He had a good relationship with his mom. He got married, and that worked out, and they pretty much lived happily ever after. But that's so rare for a hero
right.
in classical myth.
Yeah, again, it sets up kind of that Norman Bates parallel, too, which is, you know, oh, God, mother, no, you know, which is one of my favorite lines in the movie. And he, I say it to my mom all the time. And but that idea of the mother existing in his own head, just so wrapped around his own head,
yeah.
that he couldn't have a normal relationship with a woman, even though he seemed to be dying to, right?
Yeah.
So what's our takeaway? Is we're heading into phones coming up, and we'll get lots of different questions, and I have no idea where we're going to go with this when we open up the phones in a minute, but what's your big takeaway from Monsters and Monarchs?
Well, sort of as you said at the very beginning, that it would be a mistake to think that serial killing is a mostly modern phenomenon, whether you start with Jack the Ripper or not. I mean, there are certainly cases in between antiquity and Jack the Ripper as well, like, you know, medieval and early modern Germany, France, etc. But the tendency, at least when people first started studying serial killers in, you know, like say the 70s and 80s, studying them in more depth, was that the thought was that, oh, it is the deprivations of modern society. It's the depraved lifestyle. I think deprivations was the wrong word. But it's the lifestyle. It's the fact that all of the inmates were released from various asylums because we couldn't fund them anymore. It's just so many problems with modern society lead to this, you know, sudden flood of serial killers. And I mean, the one thing to definitely take away, though, is that serial killers, it's so very rare. Serial killing is so rare. You wouldn't know how rare just from the amount of attention it gets. I mean, serial killers, I don't really have a good statistic here, but I think it's like 1% of all killings are serial killings, or maybe less than that. I don't quote me on this, even though
I'm
like over the talk radio here. But they're so rare. But again, the amount of attention they get because they are so unusual and just the details of them are so different from so many other killings, the methodology that goes into them, the ritual that goes into a lot of them, they get so much more attention. And also because it goes on for such a long time, and some of them are caught and some of them are never caught. The Zodiac Killer's like, who was it? You know, right?
Right. So, well, although there's a recent, you heard the story about the guy in France who says he's cracked the code.
I know that there was a very recent cracking of one of the letters that hadn't been deciphered yet, because there was also one several years back by like a husband and wife team, and there was a more recent one. Is that the one that you mean?
Yeah, just last week, a Frenchman. There were two letters from the Zodiac Killer that hadn't been decoded, and he decoded both of them.
Oh, okay.
And he's being shunned by the Zodiac Killer community. Because he's an outsider, he hasn't paid his dues, he hasn't been enough of the, you know, hasn't been enough of these chat rooms, and when he blundered into these chat rooms saying, hey, I solved it, they just, you know, they creamed him. But he, so far, he maintains that he's got it, and I'm looking to try to book him coming up on Coast to Coast, and it wasn't a month ago that we had on the author of a book that made a very strong argument that Jack the Ripper was actually Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Oh, my God, that I haven't heard yet.
It's fascinating, and it makes perfect sense. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, failed doctor, before he wrote the Sherlock Holmes story, he loved to taunt the police. Sherlock Holmes taunts the police. I mean, there's just this list of things that bring him right into that, if not to the alleys of Whitechapel itself, certainly into unpacking the stories and revealing more about the murders than was publicly known. So how did he know that? I mean, it was a great show. To speak to that, by the way, to Dennis, I think it was, Marty said that Henry VIII might have killed several wives, but at least he had a great theme song by Herman's Hermits. No, he didn't. That's a horrible song.
I don't remember the song.
I'm Henry VIII, I am Henry VIII, I am. Haven't you seen Ghost? And it's one of those awful, and I consider it a personal professional achievement that I got to tell Peter Noon of Herman's Hermits personally. What a crappy song that was. It is such an awful song, and he knows it, but he made a lot of money on it. So, all right, very good. So we'll get to your questions and comments. Join in the conversation with Debbie Felton, Monsters and Monarchs. And I checked. So on George's Beyond Belief, I was kind of right. So it's one free episode and 99 cents for the first month. Take a look at it. Find out more at coasttocoastam.com. All right, we'll blow open the phones. We'll get you in the conversation next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.